From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. December 21st marks the first official day of winter and the winter solstice, the longest night of the year, according to Rick Klein of the Spacecraft Planetary Imaging Facility at Cornell University. Solstices and equinoxes denote either the beginnings of the seasons or the center points of them. Klein tells USA Today that Christmas, Hanukkah, and Kwanzaa, and other holidays, have arisen out of just these markings. Whether you celebrate the season by sitting around the Christmas tree, sipping hot cocoa, listening to holiday music, lighting the menorah, spinning the dreidel, eating latkes, illuminating the kanara, decorating with fruits and vegetables, wearing black, red, and green, or airing out grievances with an aluminum pole, we're going to find out the origin of these traditions. Here to guide us on that journey is the Director of International Studies at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. Herbert Berg is also a professor of philosophy and religion there. Herbert Berg, welcome to Coastline.
Good afternoon. Pleasure to be here.
Good to have you here. And we are, of course, asking you to join this conversation. If you have a question about how a particular midwinter tradition emerged, or you'd like to share your family's unique way of marking your holiday, we want to hear from you. What makes this holiday meaningful to you? What is that one thing, whether it's a practice, a ritual, a gift, a song, a family member, that takes you beyond the external and allows you to feel the meaning behind your holiday? You can reach us during this live Thursday edition by calling us at 910-343-1138 or sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. Herbert Berg, the winter solstice, that's the precise moment at which the northern hemisphere tilts farthest from the sun. So the longest night of the year, the shortest day, why are so many important holidays emerging during this time?
Well, I'm sure all of our ancestors also knew it was the shortest day of the year. And so it is a good way, you know, you could think of it as, the days are beginning to lengthen now. And so it's not, I don't think it's a surprise that many of the festivals that we're going to talk about today involve lights, whether it's candles, lights, decorating the house. I think, in that dark time, that's what we're looking. And also it's a good time for some feasting.
Now, despite the fact that there are a lot of major and minor holidays around this time, there are no Muslim holidays, and you specialize in Islamic studies. So can you kind of talk about the timing of this?
Yes. There are no Muslim or major Muslim holidays right now. But if you, me, and your listeners live long enough, there will be. The Muslim calendar is a strict lunar calendar, so it's many days shorter than the solar calendar. And in 2065, one of the Eids, Eid al-Fitr, the one at the end of Ramadan, will occur on December 29th, and Eid al-Adha, the one that occurs at the end of Hajj, will occur in 2072 on December 21st, which will be probably the solstice. And so it moves around through the calendar year. And most of the holidays, all of the Muslim holidays will more or less rotate that way too.
Does Ramadan also incorporate the idea of light in darkness?
And not quite the same way, because although it's a festival that celebrates the revelation of the Quran, it's not, and of course, light is associated with the Quran. It's not really a festival of lights in quite the same way, except insofar that the fasting occurs during the daylight hours. And so from sunrise to sunset, all the fasting occurs, and then there's a meal right afterwards.
Let's talk about Hanukkah for a moment. That just ended this year in 2017. It just ended yesterday on Wednesday. But that is a festival of lights of sorts.
Yes.
So, and yet you claim that you won't find anything about Hanukkah in the Hebrew Bible. So does that mean that it's not really a high holy day?
Well, it's not a high holy day. You know, the ones that are found in the Hebrew Bible, particularly in the Torah, the first five books of the Hebrew Bible, Tanakh, or as Christians would call it, the Old Testament. That's where the big ones like Passover and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are found. This holiday is found in, or at least the story of it, in 1st and 2nd Maccabees, which is in the Apocrypha. It's in Catholic Bibles, but not Protestant Bibles. And therefore, it is a different kind of holiday. And as one rabbi once told me, the best thing that ever happened to Hanukkah was Christmas. In some ways, it's meant to be to give Jewish children an alternative to celebrating Christmas, because it's a pretty dominating holiday.
And I've heard that there are a lot of people in Israel who don't pay as much attention to Hanukkah, and they see it as sort of an American thing. Is that because of Christmas?
Yes, because it really isn't one of the high holidays. And I imagine in Israel, because Christmas isn't as competitive, one doesn't need to emphasize Hanukkah quite as much.
Tell us about the origins of Hanukkah. What is the menorah about? What does that symbolize?
Okay. Well, in the year 167 BCE, the Jerusalem had been conquered by the Seleucids, who were an empire out of Damascus, and they and Antiochus, the king, desecrated the temple. He actually tried to turn it, he slaughtered pigs on the altar, and he tried to turn it into a temple of Zeus. This led to a rebellion against this, and quite miraculously, a rebellion that won against a fairly major empire at the time. And so when the temple was being cleansed, there is a menorah there that needed to be lit. And there was one container of oil, a special, prepared oil that would keep that should be lit in the menorah, but only enough for one day. And it miraculously lasted for 8 days until more of this special oil could be made. And that was considered miraculous. And that is what the holiday is celebrating. And that's why you see a special menorah at Hanukkah, one that has 8 branches for each day, and then one in the center for lighting the other branches each day.
So is that the difference then between a menorah and a Hanukkiah?
Yes.
The Hanukkiah has an extra spot for the...
Well, technically 2, because one is 7 and one is 9, because it has the center one that is used to light the other candles.
You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of midwinter holiday celebrations, both the secular and the religious. If we have time, we'll also get to the silly. Answering your questions on this Thursday, Herbert Berg. He is the Director of International Studies and a Professor of Religion at UNCW. We want to hear how you make your holiday special. How do you catch hold of the holiday spirit? Is it a special drink, a religious service, a game you play? Tell us about it during this live Thursday discussion by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. We're probably going to revisit Christmas a great deal during today's discussion, but let's talk first about this idea of Jesus' birth on December 25th. I grew up in a Christian family, so confused. Was told that December 25th was kind of a random date that was chosen to celebrate the birth of Jesus, and Jesus to Christians is supposedly God's Son in the flesh, the Savior of the world. That was what Christmas is about. And yet, we all celebrated this big fat white guy who wore a red suit and flew around in a sleigh through the sky all night, delivering, miraculously delivering all these gifts to every kid in the world with magic reindeer. Help.
Okay.
How do those two ideas come together?
Well, the date part is, yes, it is somewhat arbitrary, because the early Christians didn't really celebrate Christmas. Easter was by far the most important holiday. And in the 3rd century, an important church father, Clement of Alexandria, wrote he thought it might be May 20th, April 20th, or April 21st.
Others, you're talking about the birth of
the
Jesus.
The birth of Jesus, yes. Others suggested April 18th or 19th, March 25th, January 2nd. What seemed to help this is that there was a Roman solstice festival, much like solstice today, at roughly the same time, and there was a desire to sort of have competition.
And what's the name of that Roman festival?
Saturnalia. And the conception of Jesus had been associated with his crucifixion, March 25th. And therefore, 9 months later, December 25th was picked as the date. Now, it's still not celebrated technically on December 25th by all Christians. There's at least four holidays. There's, of course, December 25th, some celebrated on January 6th, some on January 7th. The Ethiopian church or calendar uses that date, and January 29th for the Armenian Patriarch in Jerusalem. And the reason those dates are different is Pope Gregory changed the calendar, and essentially 13 days disappeared from the calendar because the calendar was off every year by 10 minutes and 48 seconds or so. And so slowly the time was shifting throughout the year, and they needed to realign it. And so these days were changed, and the length of the year was changed. And so, but that was the Pope in the West, and therefore the Eastern Orthodox churches and other denominations of Christianity didn't accept that calendar for quite some time. And at least liturgically, they still have that. So there are at least four different dates on which Jesus is considered to be born by Christians.
And there are all these other holidays that a lot of people have. Most people have grown up hearing about Hanukkah and Christmas and even Kwanzaa. And we're going to get to Kwanzaa in a moment. But there are some other holidays that are a little more obscure to people in this part of the world, like Bodhi Day.
Yes.
And that means that we're going to talk about Bodhi Day when we come back from this first break. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're learning about the origin of some midwinter holiday traditions, both the widely known and the obscure. UNCW Professor Herbert Berg is taking your questions. And we also want to hear how you make your holiday special. Is there a family tradition you've developed, a song you sing, a night you dedicate to the spirit of your holiday? Tell us about it during the Live Thursday edition by calling us at 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're exploring the origins of holidays like Hanukkah, Christmas, Kwanzaa. Those are in chronological order this year, by the way, not the order of significance. And we're also exploring other less known holidays, such as marking the death of Zoroaster or Bodhi Day, which we'll hear about in a second. Herbert Berg is the Director of International Studies and a Professor of Philosophy and Religion at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and he's taking your questions on this Thursday. We'd also like to hear from you about how you celebrate your holiday. What element of celebration makes you feel the holiday spirit? Is it putting coins into the Salvation Army kettle, having all your gifts wrapped and under a tree, creating a pentacle in the backyard under a full moon? Tell us about it by calling us during this Live Thursday discussion at 910-343-1138 or by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. Herbert Berg, what is Bodhi Day?
Yeah, that's the day that the Buddha achieved enlightenment, so this is probably the most important day. But like Christmas, it also is celebrated on different days in different places. The one that is close to this holiday, December 8th, is celebrated in Japan. China, which calls the Laba, has actually a different day, and that's in January. So it's not unusual for the same holiday to appear in different places. The other one on December 26th is the death of Zoroaster. So I'm not sure. Although he's also associated with fire, I'm not sure it's a festival of light in quite the same way, since it's a death day.
Tell our listeners who is Zoroaster.
Zoroaster is the prophet that led to Zoroastrianism, a Persian prophet, probably back, there's some dispute about what day, could be 6,000 years ago or 600 years before BCE. Again, he's in the distant past, depending on which text one follows.
Okay, and then the death of Zoroaster signifies?
Oh, just that it's the death of the prophet in that sense. He was an ordinary human being in that sense. So it's not a major holiday in quite the same way that Christmas
is. So it's more like marking a date of historical significance then for Zoroastrianists.
Yes.
And what do Zoroastrianists, if that's a word, celebrate?
Zoroastrians is usually the word.
Oh, so, there you go.
Or they're often known as Parsis as well, from the word Persian.
What's the belief system?
Yes, that there was a prophet who came to tell humanity that there is a struggle between good and evil, and that by doing good words, good deeds, or bad words, bad deeds and bad thoughts, you actually contribute to one side or the other. And in some sense, at the end of life, you will be judged on a scale which one you have contributed to. And then it offered for those who contributed to the battle for good, paradise, and to other ones, it talked about a lake of fire. And this is why it's so significant for Judaism, Christianity, Islam, because it's probably the earliest tradition that talked about something that looks like heaven and something that looks like hell. In fact, their word for heaven would be paradise. And that's where we get it. It's a Persian word that we get. It's a pleasure garden.
Really?
Yeah. So
that just sounds strikingly familiar to the major world religions.
Yes. And when I teach Judaism, Christianity, Islam, that I always include Zoroastrianism in that unit because it really belongs with them because it has the same sort. It has scripture. It has prophets. It has creation of the world. It has judgment day. Heaven and hell, lots of things that are very similar to the other three traditions.
And when is Judgment Day? Is it the death of each individual, or is there, you know, in Christian theology, there's this idea that there will be a second coming of Jesus, the Savior, the Christian Savior? Is there a similar idea?
It's at a very specific time, yes. So exactly 12,000 years after the world was created. Now, which year we're in, that's another question.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Herbert Berg, who is a professor of religion at UNCW. He's also the director of international studies there. He's answering questions about why so many holidays emerge during midwinter, the winter solstice, which is today, if you're listening to the live Thursday edition. He's going to answer your questions about the origins of some of these holiday symbols and traditions. And we're also asking you to share how you celebrate your particular holiday. What makes it special for you? Have you developed a unique family or cultural tradition? Call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. We had a call from LaVon from Wilmington. He says he makes a special Puerto Rican drink called coquito. It's like a coconut eggnog. He says, recently saw the Bacardi commercial that let the secret out. Rats, thanks so much for that, LaVon from Wilmington. And of course, as we talk about Santa Claus, if we have any younger listeners, I want to assure you that while the story of Santa Claus comes from a pretty complicated tradition, he's absolutely real and he's coming to your house in a few days. So Santa Claus, yes. Where did this come from, especially for Christians?
Okay. Well, there is a historical Saint Nicholas, a 4th century bishop. He was an orphan, his parents died, left him quite wealthy and rich, and he was known for his generosity. And one of the stories that is told about him is that there was a poor man with three daughters, and he didn't have the dowry for them, and there was a danger that they might end up in prostitution. And so he dropped coins down the chimney, which just happened to land in stockings that were hung on the fireplace to dry, and then the first daughter could get married, and he did it again for the second daughter and again for the third daughter. So this might be at least a way of understanding where the tradition of hanging stockings and putting gifts in them come from, but it is associated with gifts. Our modern
and polygamy. I mean, it was going after all three daughters.
Oh no! Each daughter was marrying somebody else.
I gotcha. Okay.
So he was trying to, you know, make sure that they stayed virtuous and got married.
I see. So that's the origin, of the stocking tradition.
Yes.
What about that red suit?
Okay, that comes a little bit, because our modern Santa Claus is a combination of the British Father Christmas, the Dutch Sinterklaas, and in the U.S., the red thing, because if you look at Santa Claus in earlier depictions, he's wearing sometimes a blue outfit, sometimes a green outfit, many different colors. A lot of it was formed by sort of popular culture here. In Canada, the U.S., of course, the poem in 1821, Santa Claus, I want to make sure I get the title right in case everyone wants to look it up. sort of an adventure hymn. And of course, the visit by St. Nick's 2 years later.
The Clement Moore piece.
Yes. Yeah. And then, of course, we have Thomas Nast's picture of a plump red man as well. So that all in a red outfit. So that sort of cemented it. The particular color of red, some people will put at Coca-Cola's ad campaign, because they, in the 1930s, they really tried to push, Santa Gate associated with Coca-Cola, and therefore they made his outfit the same color as the Coke brand used. And therefore that really cemented in, although that's what I was originally told. But I have, you know, by doing some research, I found out that depiction of Santa in red as a jolly man, that goes back further. It's maybe the shade of red, or maybe popularizing Santa Claus in the U.S.
Okay.
Coke can help with that.
You mentioned a couple of characters here. Yep. Father Christmas, yes. That's a British character.
Yes.
For folks who aren't familiar with Father Christmas, explain that character.
Well, he was associated with an earlier holiday that, because it was pre-Christian or pagan, sort of got eliminated. And he was, and also a holiday that actually was eliminated, I believe, by Henry VIII when they were moving the church, breaking from the Catholic Church. So they wanted to eliminate some of the Catholic holidays. And therefore, he was bumped up to December 25th and associated with that. But he's essentially of good, a figure of good cheer, revelry, drinking and eating and feasting. And so not really in gift giver in quite the same way.
Okay, so you said pre-Christian or pagan.
Yeah.
What was the holiday that was eliminated that then got him transferred to Christmas?
Well, at that point, that was just the festival
of Saturnalia.
No, not
that's
Saturnalia,
because
it was already.
Thing.
Yeah, this was just a. I'm trying to remember actually the name of this holiday.
Okay.
It's not St. Stephen's. It's another.
So this was a specifically Catholic holiday, which Father Christmas was connected to.
Yeah.
And then
Father. Yeah. Yes, you're correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
There wasn't another name for
this guy. No.
Okay. Because he changes identities a lot.
Yes, he does.
And we're going to get to Holland in a moment.
Yes.
But so Father Christmas then got bumped up when there was a split between the Catholic and the Protestant churches.
Yes.
Okay. Now so that is why then there's this guy. Did Father Christmas have a white beard? Was he the portly white bearded guy who flew in a sleigh with magical reindeer?
The one image I've seen of him that's fairly old, he's actually, I believe, in a green robe. He's quite thin. He does have the beard, but he has got a drink in his hand, and he's reclining back a little bit. His shirt is open, so he seems to be making merry.
Okay. Now, you also mentioned, and we probably need to clarify terminology here, because when you were talking about Father Christmas, you said pre-Christian and then pagan came out kind of under your breath.
Yeah.
And I realize that for a lot of Christians, there are probably some pretty negative associations with the word pagan. But when you use it, what does it mean?
I just mean the traditions that existed around Europe, and they're not unified. They're different traditions all over the place. Every region would have had its own, but it gets lumped together in as these non-Christian traditions. They were the religious traditions of, of German descent, so they would have been of my ancestors before Christianity showed up. Christianity tended to use the word pagan. Sometimes that's negative, which is why I avoid it a little bit. And it's also not descriptive, because it makes it sound like they're all the same when they really have a lot of difference. What they were doing in Scandinavia is not identical with what they were doing in pre-Christian Spain. So it's a blanket term, and so it sometimes doesn't tell us a lot other than pre-Christian.
Are there Christians who kind of conflate the term or use them synonymously, pagan and heathen?
Yes, that's one of the reasons I'm cautious about the term, because it can be understood as something very negative.
And what does heathen mean in the Christian world?
Well, heathen is usually, again, a non-Christian. It's a derogatory term. It's usually associated with sin, someone who actually at one point it was even associated with devil worship, as, you know, because if you're not Christian and you're not Jewish, then you must be the only other option that's out there. You can call it what you will. And so that's why it has a very, very negative term. Pagan has been somewhat, by groups called neo-pagans, been sort of revitalized and adopted. I don't know if there are anyone who calls themselves neo-heathens.
If you do, give us a call. We'd like to hear about it during this live Thursday discussion. 910-343-1138 is the phone number. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. We're talking with Professor Herbert Berg from UNCW. He's the Director of International Studies there and specializes in religious studies, the study of Islam. And we'd like to hear from you about your holiday traditions, or if you have a question about the origin of a particular holiday symbol, give us a call. We have John from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hey, yes, John. Hey, I really enjoyed the show. It brings back many, many memories, which I'd like to share. One funny one, I think, with you.
Sure.
I came from a very Catholic family background. My mother was a single parent, three kids, and, you know, God love her. She did everything, dressed the tree, bought this thing, presents, put them on the tree, et cetera. Anyways, we're all upstairs on Christmas, very excited to come down and see what Santa brought us. And before we could do that, she got us all lined up on the stairs, and we had to sing Happy Birthday, Jesus, before we come down. God love her. I hope she's listening. Anyways.
To the tune of Happy Birthday?
Happy Birthday, yes, right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Is that something that you've carried forward, John, into your adult life?
Well, I'm a grandfather of nine, so I think it died in my generation, quite frankly. But I certainly remember that every year. And I think I was about 13 when I finally figured out Santa was a hoax. And I was a little slow, I think.
John, can I just ask, how did you, with that kind of religious upbringing in the Christian tradition, how did you reconcile the idea of Santa and Jesus?
Wow. I don't think we reconciled that at all. I think, you know, it was all about, you know, we went to church and mass and, you know, all that sort of stuff, but we certainly looked forward to Santa, whoever he was, visit.
That's
and I don't think there was a connection between religion and Santa.
They were just totally separate ideas for Christmas,
yeah,
for you. Well, John, thank you so much for your call and for sharing that tradition. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. Herbert Berg.
Yeah, one of the interesting things that happens with Christmas, because it's a combination of pre-Christian, Christian, and secular tradition. And there are places where Christmas is entirely secular, so the happy birthday doesn't surprise me. One of the odder things that I've discovered is in Japan, where most people aren't Christian. They may be Shinto or Buddhist. But Christmas has caught on there. And in 1970, there was an ad campaign put on by Kentucky Fried Chicken, and now it is associated eating KFC on Christmas Day. It's just one of the tradition you think.
Wow.
Yeah, and that to me is an entirely secular invention, just like in some sense the lights on, or at least electric lights on trees and things like this. So this is not uncommon, I think, for new traditions to come in, and every place Christmas seems to go, it adopts new things. And happy birthday would be a relatively recent, since the song isn't that old.
It would, and it also makes me wonder if part of the idea behind that is to keep the focus on the birth of Jesus for Christians,
yes,
instead of letting it get, spread out with Santa Claus and trees and lights and gifts and the Grinch and all of that. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. Do you think that you talk about KFC actually doing a successful ad campaign to establish their own Christmas tradition? Is Christmas spreading around the world in that kind of secular way, not necessarily related to KFC, but just because of our instant communication technology these days, the fact that you can tune in to other people's experience so easily? Do you think that Christmas is spreading just as a fun way to celebrate winter holidays?
Yes, and even in Japan, there is gift giving associated with it. Even in China, there are some, although it's obviously focused on Chinese who are Christians. But I don't think this is a new phenomenon. The Christmas tree, which we haven't talked about the origins, but its jump was really from Germany to Britain, mostly in the time around 1830, and that's because Queen Victoria had a German husband, Albert, and he set up the first Christmas tree in Windsor. And there's an image of him that was, I think, drawn in 1848 or so, and then 2 years later it was reprinted in the United States. And that is when other than the immigrants who brought Christmas trees with them, that it really starts being popularized. And so it was spread. So this sort of secular tradition, even 150, 100, or 200 years ago, was already spreading around the world. So as Christmas spreading to, you know, Japan and other areas in India as well, where Christians, you know, decorate cribs, not trees, and give out...
Cribs, as in beds for babies?
Yes. And give out sweets and cakes and stuff to their neighbors and things like that. It's a different tradition, and so it helps spread around. So it's both a, you know, it spreads as a religious holiday, as Christianity spreads, but obviously also the secular holiday. I mean, gifts... Who doesn't want gifts and a reason to celebrate in midwinter, or I should say, or shortest day or the longest day in the year, depending on which hemisphere you're in?
You said that Prince Albert?
Yes.
Albert. The Queen was married to Albert.
Yes.
Who brought the first Christmas tree into the house. Into Windsor Castle. Sorry, it's a castle. yes. Where did that idea come from? The idea of bringing a tree that somebody has chopped down, an evergreen, into the house to celebrate something?
If there is a war associated with Christmas, it's arguing who came up with the Christmas tree. So some would say the Romans, because they had evergreens and wreaths associated with Saturnalia. Some say the Viking and the Saxons, who worshiped trees. Some would say the triangular shape, because it reminded the Christians of the Trinity. Others say from the Tree of Paradise, there were these medieval mystery plays associated with Adam and Eve. And so this was the tree in the garden. And I will pause there.
Okay. Yeah. That's a lot to chew on. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. UNCW's Director of International Studies, Herbert Berg, is with us today, and he's answering your questions about this special time of year when so many religions and cultural traditions celebrate their version of hope and light during the darkest time of the year. Tell us about your holiday tradition on this live Thursday edition by calling us at 910-343-1138 or sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. When we come back, we'll hear from Brian. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. It's the winter solstice, the first official day of winter. Many religious traditions celebrate holidays during this literally darkest time of the year, and we're exploring how these celebrations evolved, both the well-known and the obscure, the silly, the secular, the holy ones. With us to answer your questions on this Thursday, Herbert Berg, Director of International Studies and Professor of Religion at UNCW. This is the last segment, so you have just a few minutes left to get your question in or tell us about your unique holiday tradition. Call us during the live Thursday show at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. Herbert Berg, just before we went to break, you were explaining the potential origins of the Christmas tree as a symbol of Christmas. You talked about the Romans and their midwinter festival of Saturnalia, the Vikings, the Tree of Paradise. So continue with that. What are some of the other possibilities for where the Christmas tree came from?
Well, in the 8th century, St. Boniface, who went from what is now Great Britain to Germany to preach, saw a bunch of people about to sacrifice a boy, and they were worshiping an oak. And in his anger, he cut down the oak tree, and a young fir sprang up. And he saw this as a sign, and it said that he put on candles so that he could preach at night. Yet another story talks about a forester who had a knocking on his door, and a poor boy was there, and he fed and washed the boy and let him sleep in his son's bed. And in the morning, a choir of angels appeared, and it turned out to be the Christ child, who then broke off a piece of fir as a gift for thank you, and then it entered into the home. Where we know it, we're getting on more historical grounds, is Martin Luther, the great reformer, is said to have been the first who brought the tree into the home. So at least, but what we can be very certain about is that the modern Christmas tree really took off on early modern Europe. And again, there's arguments. Tallinn in Estonia claims that they had the first Christmas tree, 1441. Riga in Latvia says, no, they had the first one in 1510. There are plaques for these, so you can go visit these things. And then it jumped, of course, where it caught on was Germany. Initially, a baby Jesus was on the top, and then it got replaced by angels and stars. An 18th century candle showed up. And then, of course, as I mentioned earlier, it jumped to Britain, and then from there more to the U.S. And in about when Thomas Edison invented lights, it wasn't long. I mean, he made some decorations. I don't believe he put them on trees. Where it really got popularized, putting lights on trees, electric lights, was after a fire in a hospital of a Christmas tree. And somebody came up with the idea. Somebody who started the company Noma, that still makes Christmas lights, came up with the idea of electric lights.
And because that was a thing. People used to put candles on Christmas trees, which is sort of mind-bending for me because they burn really, really well.
Yes. And initially,
do we have a death toll? How many people have died after putting candles on Christmas trees?
That I don't know. I like the earlier German tradition, which is putting edible things on trees. That way you can snack and enjoy the tree. And you probably won't catch fire.
We have an email. Brian writes, hi and happy winter solstice. I'm a third generation pagan and we celebrate the inception of Krampus. We dress up in costumes, usually stag helmets. and demonic-looking makeup. It's good fun, and it's a great way to just enjoy each other's company. Thanks for sharing that with us, Brian. Have you heard about this character, Krampus?
Yes, but I have to admit, I don't know a lot. I'm not a neo-pagan / pre-Christian pagan expert on those sort of things. Many of the festivals are actually associated with what Scandinavians call Odin, or Germanic peoples are called Woden, because he is associated with this night. In fact, because of him, that he's and also Freyr, who happens to be associated with boars, this is probably where the origin of eating ham during this time of year comes from as well. Because sometimes people think, oh, it's an anti-Jewish thing. No, it's not at all. It's just an ancient Germanic thing.
Say that again. The eating ham, that tradition may have come from a Germanic tradition of
For associated particularly with the god Freyr, F-R-Y-E-Y-R, and he's associated with boars, hunt, fertility, the harvest, and therefore you offer as a sort of sacrifice, but also something you eat, a boar. And so this is ham has always been associated with this particular time of year in northern Germany, I should say northern Europe.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking about the origins of certain holiday celebrations. A few minutes left for you to get your question in during the live Thursday discussion. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. Share your unique holiday tradition. Joanne from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Yes, nothing's been said about Clement Moore's long poem, and I always thought that that's where the red suit came from. Obviously not listening to Dr. Berg, but, you know, giving gifts and the whole thing about Christmas. Is there any truth in that, or is it just a poem?
Oh, it's a poem that was very influential in the formation of our image of Santa Claus.
"'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse." Don't worry, I'm not going to do the whole thing. Want to make sure people are with us.
Yeah, there were a lot of images of Santa Claus as quite thin. He becomes, after that poem, the jolly figure who, you know, with the red cheeks and those images started appearing. Yeah, so yeah, that is a very important poem. Although some people, this is why I mentioned another poem just before that a little bit. Some people say, some of the ideas already appeared in this previous poem, but that's just the way it is, right? The image of Santa Claus has been building. Before 1939 or 38, no one had heard of Rudolph. That was an invention of somebody who added yet another reindeer because there was a department store that gave away coloring books. And they thought, oh, well, we can save money if we create our own. And a writer came up with them. And in 1949, Gene Autry made it into a song, and then it became even more popular. And suddenly, you know, the sort of stories around Santa Claus expand.
There you go.
Thank you so much for your call, Joanne. You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about the origins of holiday traditions during the midwinter season, including Christmas, of course. We're going to get to Kwanzaa, and we're going to talk about Festivus and Schwarze Piet. But first, let's hear from Ken from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi. Just as a sideline, a little addition. The Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, because I worked for the company, was the invention of a copywriter at Montgomery Ward and Company in Chicago. So just thought I'd mention
really?
That.
But you worked for Montgomery Ward, Ken?
Yeah, as a copywriter. And so it was a big deal every year. They'd say, you know, the real reason he has Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer is because of, you know, so-and-so, whatever his name was.
Robert May.
And I don't believe he got any royalties on it, by the way. But because he was working for the company. But the reason I called was I guess it's kind of funny. I grew up in a very predominantly Jewish neighborhood in the 1950s. And my mother came from an Orthodox home, so we had Hanukkah. My father came from a much more, I guess, ecumenical home. His mother gave him the choice of whether to go to temple or church. He went to the temple because it was closer. He didn't have to walk as far. So seriously, but her own background was very unusual that way too. In any event, he brought over like the Christmas tree. He brought over the Christmas tradition. So we had this every Christmas we'd have this great big fake cardboard fireplace sitting in our apartment and a Christmas tree with toys. And when Hanukkah and Christmas coincided with each other, as they often do, we'd have the menorah sitting on top of the fake fireplace. And I'd have friends that would come over and they were all like yeshiva buffers. They were all like, you know, kids who went to temple and everything. And they'd look and they'd go, what's going on? What's happening here? Why do you have a menorah and a Christmas tree? And
have you kept any of those traditions today?
Yeah. Every girl that I married, and there's been three of them, were not Jewish. So we've always had Christmas and Hanukkah. We just finished lighting the last Hanukkah light last night. So, yeah, we've carried it over for sure.
That's great. Ken, thank you so much for sharing that experience.
You bet.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Professor Herbert Berg about the origins of some of these holiday traditions. Before we leave Christmas, David Sedaris made famous this Dutch tradition in which 6 to 8 black slaves, I think they're trying to move the idea to a kinder, gentler version of Schwarze Piet, but what is this idea of people dressing up in blackface and kind of accompanying Sinterklaas in Holland?
Well, this tradition may have been brought from a time when the Netherlands and Spain were under one king. And these characters are actually helpers. There could be more than one, although it's one. Sometimes it's six. The numbers varies a little bit. But they're in something essentially Moorish dress. And because Moors, at least as Europeans, came from northern Africa through Spain, they are black. So they are mischievous helpers, at least originally. And also traditionally, they would be the ones who would punish children. They had a little stick if they were naughty. But now, actually, they're just associated with giving candy. Actually, one of the scary things was if children were naughty, they would take them in their bag and take them back to Spain.
Calling them helpers, not slaves.
Yes, well, that is maybe the cleaned up language of this. It depends whether you want to see Santa as a slave owner, which would be a little bit problematic.
But he kind of was in this tradition, right?
Well, I don't know if the elves get paid either, so I'm okay. I don't want to get in trouble there. It's a tradition where we see some of, because the blackface has a really negative association here in the United States because of the way it was used and the way it depicted African Americans. And so some Dutch, of course, people are saying, well, that's a uniquely American issue. Why are you exporting this and expecting us, you know, to this? Because it doesn't have these connotations. And so there is actually a real battle in the Netherlands now, because some are saying, now we need to stop this tradition. And others are saying, no, it's just a tradition. It goes back hundreds of years. It's not associated with
a white tradition.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I think that's part of the problem
is
that it's a white culture that instituted this tradition of blackface, which is yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I understand why it's problematic, but I'm trying to see it from, you know, people who just say this is just an ancient tradition. It's not connected with American slavery or the depictions of blackface, which were comical and demeaning in the United States. Although some would say, no, actually, this is demeaning when you look at the story. So,
yes,
it's not for me to say whether you have to change.
You are,
but I would suggest that since Christmas traditions change so much, it's one of the things that I've sort of been emphasizing. This might be one that could be changed.
What is Kwanzaa for those who haven't grown up celebrating it? This is a relatively new holiday. It just celebrated its 50th anniversary last year, I believe.
Yes. It was created in 1966, specifically as an African-American holiday. It emphasizes feasting and gift giving from December 26th to January 1st. It comes from the Swahili word meaning first fruits of harvest, and it's trying to reconnect with African culture and heritage. It's not necessarily a religious holiday. It also has seven candles, and each of them symbolizes seven principles. The term seven comes up quite a bit, and I won't go into all of the details, but the candles are green, red, and the one in the center is black, and one is lit on each day, and each day represents one of these principles. Also has seven symbols, things like crops, a mat, corn, a unity cup, all of which would be significant to these principles as well. The appropriate thing to say is joyous Kwanzaa, and as African Americans who are predominantly Christian, and so celebrate Christmas. Over the years, the two have been blended, and there doesn't seem to be any problem with that.
What are the principles that are kind of extolled and explored through the celebration of Kwanzaa? Okay.
One would be unity. One is self-determination. One is collective work and responsibility. The fourth one is cooperative economics, and then purpose, creativity, and faith.
And is there a text that goes along with this?
There are rituals that go along with it for each night, but I'm not familiar with the text. If there is, I haven't read it. So I will say I'm a little bit ignorant on that.
Festivus. Originated, I think, on an episode of Seinfeld, but the idea has persisted. What is Festivus, and how do adherents or the rest of us celebrate?
Well, Festivus, actually, from one of the writers of Seinfeld, this person's father had created this. And so Seinfeld adopted this. And it was in the episode where George Costanza is trying to fake getting out of certain responsibilities by saying he has an alternative holiday. And so he, although he hates Festivus, he brings it up. And so it is associated, I just found out recently, it's celebrated on December 23rd. I didn't know till recently what the date was. But there's an aluminum pole, and it has things like the airing of grievances, and then there are feats of strength. And so it was meant to be a humorous depiction, but it resonated with some people because it was a Festivus for the rest of us. So it's a sort of a secular holiday. And just as one of our callers has these sort of neo-pagan holiday, which is sort of almost in contrast, and Kwanzaa was sort of say, well, we need something that is African-American. It seems that this is something adopted by some people who are secular, say, well, we want a holiday too, and at least this one makes us laugh.
According to the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, this is the time of the holidays, and holiday encompasses pretty much all the big commercial holidays, according to this church, from November to December. They claim the Pastafarians, which is what they are, have won the season because they say a special thanks should go out to Walmart, who has rejected the Christian phrase Merry Christmas in favor of the Pastafarian greeting Happy Holidays. Does that fly with you, Herbert Berg?
Well, no, I am quite happy to use Happy Holidays, but not to sort of erase Christmas at all. As I tried to point out earlier, there's at least four different dates that are Christmas holidays or celebrate Christmas. So we can say Happy Holidays Christian-wise. If you want to be more pluralistic, Kwanzaa, Hanukkah, the other holidays I mentioned, they can be included in Happy Holidays as well.
That's this edition of Coastline. Herbert Berg, what a pleasure having you with us today. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Associate producer is Rachel Keith. Production assistant is Caitlin Hanrahan, who is also our chief engineer today. Caroline DeVries is our webmaster. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast or find it on the WHQR app. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 2. Happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas, joyous Kwanzaa. Have a great Festivus. Thanks for listening. Coastline is back Wednesdays and Thursdays at noon in 2018. See you in the new year. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.